Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Bite-Sized Blessings podcast. This weekend, I'm introducing you to Leroy Slanzy. And once again, I found myself enchanted by another human being who is doing good works out in the world. Now, Leroy has 25 years of experience as a special education teacher, classroom teacher, and principal. And he's dedicated his life to cultivating relationships built on kindness, empathy, and trust. And these days, he's working for the Lower Nicola Indian Band up there in British Columbia, Canada. Now, Leroy grew up within Indigenous communities and was influenced by the teachings and values of the people he was surrounded by. And we have a conversation about colonialism. We get a little bit into reconciliation, into what is happening these days within Indigenous communities and the reparations that are happening and I hope are still to happen in the future. But it's not only that. Leroy talks about what it's like to be a leader in a field where kids are kind of, destructive these days. They're not resilient. They're not able to bounce back as readily. And we talk about the work that Leroy is bringing into the world, the work that he's fostering, which is to help teachers, educators, leaders, and parents understand that there are many ways to bring up children who are resilient, who are able to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and by opposing, withstand them. And I want you to take note of the fact that I just dropped a little Shakespeare into the intro there. But I'm going to let Leroy explain the work that he's doing in the world and how he inhabits the world. So without further ado, here's the next episode of the Bite-Sized Blessings podcast.
Have you ever heard of the expression shama? Have you ever heard of what a shama is? So Indigenous people where I'm from, they call white people shamas. It's like the N-word for white people, I guess. And when I first got there, the first reaction was, you know, and it wasn't said directly to my face, but there was a lot of, is he going to turn this into a shama school, into a white school? And I didn't. I embraced, I went in knowing chief and council needed literacy and numeracy rates to go up because kids need reading, writing, and arithmetic. But I've embraced everything that they are. And now I'm allowed to, it's funny because there's certain things you can't say as a white person that Indigenous people can say. And I now, when I say something, they joke about it. They look at me and they say, you know, you're allowed to say that now. Well, if I was at a workshop or professional development, that's really easy because I have no problem with structure. If it was a dinner party, I'd probably shy away a little bit because I'm pretty private and a little bit of an introvert outside of work. You know what? I would describe myself through my family. I would start there, and I'm the son of an Italian immigrant, and you know, he came over here a while ago. I grew up in a very small town in British Columbia, so my roots are rural, and I still can't do big city. I like to visit big cities, and I, from an early age, have just migrated towards, you know, working with people, kids. I've always had those sort of, you know, character traits, and, you know, eventually I ended up in education where I think I tried to not be in education. I tried to go into social work, and I just kept getting drawn back into working with kids and educating and teaching and leading. So that's me in a nutshell right there.
I love it. I was going to ask now, what kind of compelled your ancestor to move to Canada? I'm so curious.
Poverty. And it was the end of World War II for my dad, and they had no money. And at the time, I believe in Canada, they were, they were trying to recruit immigrants from Eastern Europe. And so the railway was big. So he came to Canada and they both started working for the Canadian National Railway, which is the biggest railway company in our country. And the rest is history. They moved into Canada and started working on the railway, and he became a mechanic, and they've been here ever since. Yeah.
And I do have to say, and we were talking about bucket list items before we started this conversation, and another bucket list I have, I'm going to like come to Canada and never leave, is to take the railway from Vancouver through Banff, because I've heard it's astonishing.
Stunning. It is. It really is. Yes. I have done that actually, because my dad, being on the railway, we used to travel because his family was in Edmonton, which is Alberta, is just past, you go through the Kananaskis Mountains and whatnot. And we used to take the train because it was cheaper to go from BC to Alberta. And so I did it lots. Yeah. I remember the conductor come and give us these little cardboard cutouts of the Via Rail train. And yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. The dome car is the funnest because you can sit up in the dome and really see things. So if that's your bucket list item, you need to do it for sure. Yeah.
I know. I think at this point I should start on the West Coast and do the Queen Charlotte's, then take the train across the country. But I have heard that it doesn't go all the way to like Prince Edward Island. It kind of stops, and then you have to find another way to get to PEI. But I will get there by hook or by crook. This is happening.
There you go. There you go. I'm with you.
Not to generalize, but when your family came to Canada, did they bring a lot of their kind of heritage with them? Did you grow up in an Italian household?
Well, you know what's interesting about my dad? I think when he came to Canada, he felt more Canadian than he did Italian, because he grew up in the Alps, and so northern Italy there in the Dolomites. And you know, he grew up as one of those guys who would pick mushrooms and hunt and fish. And so when he came to Canada, he, some of his closest friends were Indigenous people, and mostly because they hunted and fished. And so for him, becoming part of the Canadian way in terms of the wilderness was all for him. And I don't even remember the last time I heard my dad having an accent. My friends think he does every now and then, but like I talked to my Uncle Julius, and he's still got a thick Italian accent. And my dad, he just embraced being here, and actually didn't go home for about 15, 16 years after he got here. He was so enamored with Canada. So, but we did, I mean, you know, my staple is pasta, and, you know, it's, it, there's, you know, and I've been back home to Italy, I don't even know how many times now, 6 or 7, and because his sisters are still there and whatnot. So it is still part of our you know, family connection. We go home when we can, and yeah.
Amazing. And I was going to ask, now you said that you grew up in rural Canada. So do you think that because of where your father grew up as a child, that caused him to search out a place that was closer to the wilderness when he emigrated?
No, he came for work. Like he, like most immigrants, they come to a country because where they're living isn't doing what it needs to for their family, right? And so they migrate because of work. So, you know, he came here because there was a job with the railway, and, you know, the place that he ended up when he came to Canada, no knock on Albertans or anything where he went, but it's kind of in the middle of the nowhere. There's no mountains. So you think a kid from the Alps showing up in flatland Alberta, it was tough. But so we ended up in a very small town in British Columbia because there was another job opportunity that nobody else wanted to go to. And he came here and he went, wow, because the mountains in the Fraser Canyon where we're from are very Alp-like, very Dolomite-like, beautiful, beautiful. So I think that I was after probably being here for about 2 or 3 years where he finally was like, holy shit, this is beautiful. And you know, we're in a small town. And like I said, he made connections with the Indigenous people that were living around the area. And the rest was history.
Now, I'm curious, did you share his passion for kind of like foraging and going out into the woods? And what, why are you making a big smile right now? Why are you smiling like
well,
that?
Well, it's funny because my dad is an interesting story. He's a heavy duty mechanic. I do not touch my vehicle. My dad's a hunter. I will eat deer meat and elk and moose, but I cannot shoot an animal. One thing I do is I do fish. I fly fish all the time. So that I did get from my dad. I do fish, but I'm not much of a hunter. I like to hike, and I think that's what I've, because we used to go hiking and go pick mushrooms and all that stuff. So I go hiking with them. And so now I love to hike. It feels very therapeutic for me. So there are things I got from them, but I'm not off foraging for mushrooms. Although I work in an indigenous school now, so my school's often off foraging and tea picking and mushroom picking and huckleberry picking. So it's funny, I've kind of fallen in my dad's wheelhouse, just career-wise, actually. So yeah.
Thank you for that. I'm always so curious about ancestry, ancestors, you know, what comes down the line, what doesn't come down the line. Mm-hmm. So thank you for indulging me. Well, my second question always is, did you grow up in a religious household? And if so, like, how did that change over the years for you?
Sure. Well, this one's easy. So you can think an Italian dad, he's Roman Catholic. Right. So my dad actually married a woman from Canada, not an Italian woman. So he came to Canada. My mom and dad married. Mom didn't speak Italian. Dad didn't speak Canadian. And they got married. And you can imagine. So 13 years later, they separated once they got to know each other. But which ties into the Catholicism story. I was raised in a Catholic home. I was actually an altar boy. I had aspirations to be a priest at one point. My favorite person in the world was Sister Sharon. Father Price was pretty awesome as well. And then my parents divorced. And then in the Catholic Church at the time, once you're divorced, you've now breached the Catholic contract, and we never went back to church. And and I've just never it's kind of was left in the tailspin. But I'm a very kind and considerate and compassionate person, and I think that has a lot to do with Father Price and Sister Sharon. I'm not a religious person. I'm pretty spiritual, I think, particularly now that I work in an indigenous community, and I learn a lot about, you can see the medicine wheel, the sacred circle behind me, and I adhere to a lot of that. It's pretty awesome stuff. I've never pushed religion on my kids, but it's their choice. If they want to believe or go down whatever path, I will support them 100%, because it's theirs to own, not mine. So that's my story. I was an altar boy at one point. Yes, yeah.
Now, I'm ever so curious because, you know, I have met many nuns in my life just based on things that I've done. And a lot of them are super fierce. Was Sister Sharon fierce?
No. You know what, Sister Sharon? So when you're in a Catholic church and the priest comes out, there's usually altar boys in front of the priest and then altar boys behind the priest, because you go out in front of the altar, you kneel, and then you go into the pews. And I'd always try to get the spot right behind Father Price, because that means when I went back into the pew, I got to ring the bell or I got to go and pour the wine for him at the altar. And so I did that because I loved ringing the bell, and I would ring it too hard or I would spill the wine. And Sister Sharon used to just get a kick out of me, and she would just laugh, and because I was always messing around. And, she was just someone who just kind of took me under her wings. Maybe it was because I was constantly messing up and she found it amusing, but there were strict nuns, believe me, when we went to catechism, but Sister Sharon was not, and neither was Father Price. Like we played tackle football on the lawn at the church, and, being in a very small town, that's where the community was and stuff like that. So yeah, you're bringing me back. I haven't talked to, actually the first open casket funeral I've ever been to was Sister Sharon's, and that was the last one. I don't do funerals with open caskets now. Hurt too much. So
thank you for that. I do want to say that I so appreciate the medicine wheel behind you. I identify as a panentheist, which means that I believe that spirit, God, great creator is in everything, including this conversation, including that image of the medicine wheel behind you, and all the other beautiful images that you have hanging on the wall behind you. But also, more importantly, in the animals and the plants, and the earth. that is, you know, just outside my door. And I think it is, at least for my soul, it's so important to be close to nature, however I can do it. There's just a different vibe or feeling if you take a walk in the city versus if you take a walk or a hike in the woods or near the ocean. It's just a different kind of energy. There's an intimacy about walking in the woods or walking next to the ocean with, for me at least, great creator or spirit. And I really appreciate the medicine wheel behind you. I've interviewed some really fascinating indigenous elders on this program. And I think, I always think there's always more to learn. So I'm devouring books on different Native American faiths in the U.S. And I'm always learning. But I love that you have bear. And I think that's wolf. And is it crow or raven?
There's a raven. There's a wolf, bear, coyote, because the coyote's a trickster in most business cultures. Up here, there's a beaver on the wall too. I actually just tried beaver the other day at our school. I never thought I would eat a beaver, but I did. There's still trap lines running for a lot of indigenous communities. So yeah, I've also eaten a kangaroo when I was in Australia. So those two things in my wildest dreams, I never thought I would do, but I did it begrudgingly. And yeah, but yes, those are part of a program. I do a program called Play is the Way. It's a social emotional learning program. It's about behavior education. And those are the key concepts that have been indigenized actually by a local artist. So that's what that's part of there. Yeah.
I do think, and I'm just going to go a little serious here for a moment.
Sure.
Besides the fact that I try to channel coyote as much as possible in my life without, you know, hurting anyone else or you know, maiming anyone else or whatever that looks like.
Sure.
I do think, you know, in the U.S., well, all over the world, but U.S. and Canada especially, there's a lot of reconciliation that needs to happen between, you know, we can bring the church in, the Catholic Church in, but also colonists, colonizers, settlers, and the indigenous communities that were displaced or killed or hurt or traumatized. And I find it really provocative and interesting that you work in an indigenous school because there are generations of healing that needs to happen. And a lot of apologizing and, I mean, giving back and reconciliation, as I said. Do you ever think about that with the work that you're doing?
Yeah, well, in the public school system and federally here in Canada, we have, they're called the Truth and Reconciliation Calls to Action. So it's actually, there's laws around that where the school system, the public school system that is, have to do their part in terms of reconciling what happened to our Indigenous people here. I personally think now that I'm not in the public system anymore, and now that I'm in an Indigenous school and working on an Indian reserve, I'm learning a lot more about the approach I wished I would have took when I was in the public schools. And I think, you know, I don't know, in the United States, I think they might've been called boarding schools when Indigenous kids were taken from here, they're called residential schools. And, you know, in my school, the majority, you know, over half, maybe three quarters of my staff are all residential school survivors, lots of elders. It's a beautiful thing. And I left the public education system probably about 2.5 years ago. For political reasons, which is part of the reason why I wrote my book on emotional schools, and because I wanted to dive deeper into truth and reconciliation. And as a small child, like we grew up in a town called Boston Bar, and I actually didn't live in Boston Bar. I lived outside of Boston Bar, right beside an Indian reserve called the Boothroyd Indian Reserve. And so I grew up with Indigenous kids because my father had Indigenous friends. And so for me, I've never known any different. And then when I went to high school, of course, and then college, I went to a bigger center. But for me, it's always been very natural connecting with the Indigenous community. And I find it funny because a lot of people are afraid to go on reservations and they're worried. And, you know, and I just find it funny because Indigenous people are the most welcoming people you could ever meet, especially even after what happened to them. I mean, there's a level of trust because they've been burned by the systematic, you know, racism and how they've been treated. And I know there is racism for sure. But once you're in an Indigenous community, they want to know about our culture just as much as we want to know about their culture. And I'm very grateful for where I'm at right now in terms of, you know, being immersed more than I've ever been. And, you know, we don't talk about truth and reconciliation in my school. We don't talk about residential schools in my school. We talk about the sacred circle. We talk about going to the water and washing off. We smudge our, you know, we have kids in this one particular class. They're smudging, you know, people and the building almost every day. We drum, we sing. We had a hunting camp last week where we skinned a deer and, you know, you learned about all the pieces of the deer and, you know, and the kids understood that an animal is sacred and they've given their life for us. And so you learn through the eyes of what it's like for Indigenous people and not, yes, the truth and reconciliation calls to action are very important and they're great for people to learn and understand. But I don't think you really get to understand them until you're, you know, hanging out with an elder every day for 6 hours a day. And, you know, and the kids and the people that I get to hang out with. And it's pretty, I'm in a pretty awesome spot. Like, yeah, my life changed moving there. You know, it's been great.
I don't know if you can speak to this, but I just had for my episode 200, Dr. Louis Malmedrano, who's written, I don't know, like 10 books. He's, as he calls, he's Heinz 57, but he is very Indigenous. And he was talking, one of his conversations with me on the podcast was he was lamenting the fact, you know, Indigenous intelligence, their knowledge about medicine ceremony, their knowledge about healing and ceremony is very carefully guarded because that is intelligence and wisdom that has been cultivated over eons. And, you know, he discussed some of the more, you could call them supernatural events that have happened with medicine, men and women that, you know, with our Western mindset are, we can't explain it. We literally can't explain how these things are happening. Mm-hmm. And so he said, you know, a lot of youngsters in the Indigenous communities across the U.S., they no longer want to study to be medicine men and women because, you know, the outside world is so attractive and it's kind of enchanting and it's addictive. And why would you want to give up your life for this other lifestyle? And he said he was saying he really wanted, you know, he's speaking generally, for tribes to open up their healing ceremonies, their teaching ceremonies, so that other people can come in and learn how to heal and how to change things for the better for all of humanity, because we need that. Mm-hmm. And so he was really kind of nonplussed about the fact that all these really powerful elders are passing away and their knowledge and wisdom is passing away with them. I don't know if you have, are you having that experience in Canada?
Well, so this is the part, and I don't want to offend you or the other person. When we use that pronoun we, as in we need that, an Indigenous person's going to hear that. And it's like, haven't we or you taken enough? And so that's where, you know, that's where we have to be very careful as non-Indigenous people. Because I'll give you a good example. So my PE teacher fractured her arm. She's got a cast on it. You know, she's been going back and forth to the doctor. And on Friday was a professional development day, so teachers weren't there. But this one particular elder was there because she's actually translating some books from English into Inkakletmik. And she showed up and she's like, where's Alex? I'm like, she's at a Pro D. And actually, no, it wasn't the Pro D. It was a different day that she was off. Sorry. And I'm like, oh, well, is there something you needed? She goes, well, I just made her some medicine for her arm. I made her some medicine that's going to help her heal. And, you know, it's like, oh, that's fantastic. She's not here, but I'm sure she'll be here. Don't worry. She's like, I'll get her tomorrow. I'll make sure she's here. But I made sure I made the medicine. And so it's not an unwillingness to share. It's a willingness to share when there's trust that You know, what's held sacred is sacred. And, you know, when things, and I can tell you, elders are very well aware. And you got to remember, when we talk Indigenous people, there's hundreds of tribes across North America. And so what I'm experiencing with the Inklutmik people may be different than the Silk people, even though they're all very connected to Washington and Spokane and that area, right? Their tribe seems to be the same, but they're very well aware of their language, and it's why they're translating books. And it's why, like in my school, kids are required to take Inklutmik from kindergarten to grade 7. Like, I'm learning how to speak Inklutmik myself. So we're doing what we can to preserve the language and to do all those things. And they're aware that their elders are passing away and their language is dying, and some of their secrets are going with them. But I can tell you a lot of the tribes and the communities that are more progressive, we'll go back to this gentleman that you were talking about living in both worlds, is that there's enough Indigenous people that do live in both worlds quite successfully, and they're helping to spearhead the preservation of a lot of these traditions and cultures and documenting them. And one thing that Indigenous people are quite fearful of is profit, because profit is what got them in this mess to begin with. Like, when the Europeans showed up here and offered trinkets and whatnot, which then turned into alcohol and other things, which, as we know, led to a whole bunch of other things, you know. And so, you know, it's not that indigenous people don't want. I work for a band that's doing, they own a mining company, construction company. They're doing very well. And it's not that they're afraid of it, but they're afraid of somebody else coming in and capitalizing and monopolizing on what they have for their own gain and not for Indigenous people. And so, you know, that proverbial we have to be cognizant of the fact that's colonization, right? That's the truth and reconciliation piece, is that we really need to understand that when we want to reconcile with Indigenous people, is they have a lot to share and a lot to give. And I find a real strong connection with our Italian culture in terms of the generosity and eat, 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 and all this, you know, these things that go along with being Italian and whatnot. And the Indigenous people are the same. When we have parent gatherings or we have elders luncheons and whatnot, very giving, very open and kind people, and they get a real kick out of, I get laughed at every day when I try to speak the language and I mess it up, and, you know, it's cute to them, but they're appreciative, right? And they do have a lot to give, but they're going to give it on their terms where they're not going to be exploited. And so that's the piece about the, you know, when they're trying to decolonize or those truth and reconciliation, we've got to stop looking at it through a white man lens in the terms of, you know, this is what we need. And it's like, well, yeah, that might be what you need, but we're not giving it to you until we're ready to share. And that's what, like I said, that's what got them into trouble 500 years ago when, you know, Christopher Columbus showed up or the Spaniards showed up down there and whatnot, right? So, you know, they're still feeling that the consequences and the pain of being put on reservations and thrown into residential schools and the genocide that happened in both the United States and Canada, right? So
thank you for that. I actually discovered, I don't know if you're familiar with the language app Duolingo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My son's on it every day. He's learned to speak Italian and he's fluent now. In like the last year, he's fluent.
Amazing. Oh my gosh.
I don't know what his streak is, but he's flying. Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, I don't know. In the last year and a half, maybe 2 years, they added Navajo. And so
Interesting.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And so I thought, I live in the desert Southwest. They speak Navajo down here. And I thought, you know what? I think, you know, and I'm pretty good with Spanish, you know, Italian is a romance language. So there's, you know, there's some dovetailing there. And I just thought, I've heard Navajo is incredibly challenging, just unbelievably challenging. But I thought, you know, I can do this. I can, if I do it every day, by the end of the week, I was like, there is no way I can do that, because it is so different. And the syllables and the sound, my mouth doesn't make some of the sounds.
Yeah.
I don't have the capacity. It is incredibly tonal. Also, it almost sounds like a song when people are speaking it. It's so beautiful, but I also know my limits. And I don't know. How are you experiencing the language you're learning?
Well, you know, it's funny. You start with, for example, one of the things that we say every day, every morning when kids show up or when we see each other, it's Yadikshin Wan Wan. It's a good morning is what we say, right? And you know how to say Kuksham is thank you. And I know how to ask for more food, and I know how to introduce myself and my father and my mother, because that's one of the biggest things that Indigenous people do when they do meet people that are from their community. They'll introduce themselves, they'll introduce their mother, they'll introduce their father, even though they're not there. But that's what you do. So I would, you know, my suggestion, just based on what I'm experiencing in the last few years, is learn those basic greeting things like thank you and it's a good day. Because then you learn about it's not good morning, it's a good day, because everything is a positive spin on it, right? And or being able to say goodbye, just like in Italian, when you say ciao, come va, you want to learn how to say hi, how are you? You want to learn, you know, some of those generalities. And when you say Yadikshin Wan Wan, you know, in the morning and then afternoon, you'd say, yeah, you know, Yahaswichin, and it's a good afternoon. You learn those things and it's appreciative, right? And so my suggestion is just learn some phrases that allow you to say good morning to someone or thank you. And it's amazing, you know, how people will kind of just look at you and appreciate it, you know? And so if you have that opportunity, yeah, do it. But yeah, we actually recognize our kids on our Monday morning assembly when they're using the language outside of the class and on the playground or wherever. Their name goes in a little can and they get recognized once a week, and which is pretty cool. Yeah. And then of course, when we drum and we sing in the language, and it was funny, I was in Seattle, when was that? Probably about 3 or 4 months ago in the summertime. And there's a welcome song that we sing at our school. And I was in Seattle and there was a Palestinian protest. And so I'm just curious, because I'm not from a small town, I don't see a lot of protests. So I was just kind of hanging back, saying, I wonder what this is going to look like in the United States of America. And all of a sudden they had some Indigenous people there, and, you know, representing the same ideals as the Palestinian people, you know, and I think slightly a little more intense for Indigenous people here. But they started drumming and they started singing the welcome song. And I'm like, I'm 5. And I was able to sing along with them because I knew the words. So that just goes to show you, 600 kilometers, or whatever it is in miles for you guys, 300 miles away, you know, that welcome song is traditional, you know, in Seattle, Washington, as it is up here in Merritt, British Columbia, which was pretty cool. And I think if you can ever, you know, drum and sing and have that opportunity, it's pretty awesome. It just gives you goosebumps too, the drumming and the sing, especially when they get the big drum out and they start really ramping it up. It's pretty cool.
Incredible experience, and also kind of in a place where you just did not expect it. It was just a surprise. That's really fabulous. Mm-hmm. I would love for you to kind of describe how you came to write your book. Just how did your book come about? If you want to, you don't have to.
Yeah, no, I do. No, I take a deep breath, because it's a worldwide problem right now. And, you know, I think for you guys in the United States, I mean, your gun laws are slightly different than everywhere else in the world, which I think contributes to the mass shootings you guys experience. But I think at the core, what we see is that there are kids who are struggling with their mental health. And it's not just Canada. It's, you know, I'm connected with this program with people in Australia and New Zealand. And of course, my family in Italy, my aunts were teachers. They're retired now, but the world has changed. And what we have is we have a world full of kids who can't cope, who can't handle the slightest stressors because of a lot of factors that have changed for them in their generation. And so what we're seeing in classrooms is, you know, we used to see 1 to 2 kids struggling with their emotions or their behavior or their mental health and whatnot. And now it's 7, 8, 9 kids in a class, and teachers are finding it harder and harder to teach math and science and socials and English, those subjects, because they're so busy dealing with behavior. And you know, the more aberrant the behavior, the greater the cry for help. And you see, you've probably seen the TikTok videos and videos of kids being absolutely disrespectful and yelling and screaming and swearing. And that, those are just cries because they don't know what to do, right? They don't know how to manage their emotions. And so they become victims to their emotions. And so I wrote the book to just kind of outline what is happening for our kids and why it's happening for our kids. And then I talk about the importance of understanding emotions and how to implement that and that and to integrate that into our school system. So, you know, we can, you know, help curb this generation of kids that can't cope and to build those, you know, those characteristics of perseverance and grit and resilience that, you know, us Gen Xers who are drinking out of garden hoses and didn't wear helmets on our bikes, right? I mean, yeah, that's us, right? And so, you know, and it's not, we don't get to blame this generation of kids for that, because, you know, we're growing up in a generation of helicopter parents and lawnmower parents, and, you know, they are more connected than any generation ever that's existed. And, you know, but what comes with that is a lack of building perseverance through play and through, you know, through conflict and through trial and error when you're, you know, not in contact with your parents for 4 or 5 hours because there's no cell phone and you're just out playing and you've got to deal with whatever you're dealing with. And so we've hit this place in our school systems where they're emotional places, and, you know, and they're harder and harder, and there is a looming mental health crisis. It's quite frankly almost already here, and it's part of the reason why I had to leave the public school district, because I just kept banging my head against the wall with, you know, people at the district level and government, because they're just, you know, they keep dumping money into management and into middle management. And you know, in the States, I feel so sorry for teachers down there because they make no money. And they have no money for resources, and their class sizes are too big, and they have this system that's based on assessment. So your kids have to score a certain assessment for your school to get funded or your teacher to be, and it's all a moot point. So, you know, as successful as I was in the public system, I just wanted to go and to a different system. And I'm so thankful I did, because I get to run the school the way it should be run. The dollars are there because we're not, I have one boss, the director of education. There's no superintendent. The money goes to the kids in our school, and we have the staffing, we have the paraprofessionals. And so I started writing the book actually 2 or 3 years ago, and I just put it on the back burner because I was so stressed, and it was hard being a, you know, a single dad with two kids, and my ex-wife is there. So I'm not, she's helping me raise my kids as well. And, you know, but it's still tough, and watching my kids go through their own trials and tribulations as teenagers, and then being a high school principal, like I've been a high school principal, middle school principal, elementary school principal. And so I felt, you know, I needed to get the message out there that there's a problem and we need to make a change. And I get so frustrated with school districts and states and provinces, because they'll bring in professional development for teachers around assessment and around teaching pedagogy. And it's like, if we do not deal with the social emotional well-being of our kids and deal with this emotional intelligence crisis and this character and this perseverance and this intrinsic motivation crisis, kids aren't going to want, they're not going to be ready to learn. So you can have the greatest math program, the greatest language arts program, but if you have kids who aren't ready to learn or capable of learning, you're never going to get to that great assessment piece. And it's like you're putting the cart before the horse. And so, you know, there's a lot of schools who are kind of figuring it out now because the behavior is so atrocious. And when I say that, you know, 60% of kids in school do not have behavior issues. They're doing great. Parents have done a great job. But the problem is it used to be 10% of the kids that would struggle with their behavior and cause a disruption, but now it's 30. So you try to manage a class when you have 30 kids and 10 kids are off the, you know, swinging off chandeliers, being disrespectful, you'll never get to teaching for those other 20 kids. And so it's just this snowball. And so that's why I wrote the book. And I actually wrote two books. There's another book behind me. It's a breathing strategy book that it's for parents and teachers. It's called And Breathe. And that book is to help parents and teachers to help kids to self-soothe when they're feeling stressed. Because that's the biggest thing. Kids can't self-soothe anymore. They grab a phone or their parents put a phone in front of their face, or their parents are on the phone themselves and they're not helping their kids co-regulate their emotions. So I was just trying to, lay some groundwork and draw attention to what's going on in the schools. And then the breathing book I used to supplement. And I actually just finished the third book that's going to be released November 1st. And it's called The New Leadership Paradigm, Beyond Credentials and the Letters Behind Your Name. I'm kind of going after this whole notion that, letters behind your name mean you're going to be a good leader and you can do the right thing. So I'm kind of, even though I have letters, you can see mine are behind me. But I think leadership needs to open their eyes to leading through emotional intelligence as well. And so that's what that book is. So when I write books and when I do these things, it's to draw attention to the medicine wheel and to what we really need to do differently in our education system if we want kids to be successful. And that was a long tangent there.
No, but it was perfect. You actually perfectly answered my question. And I wish I would have known as a kid how to self-soothe, or that even that was a thing. I mean, it wasn't a thing when you and I were growing up. That kind of language, if it was a thing, it was only in very certain places, certainly not in the Midwest where I was growing up.
But you had to. The thing is, you never heard of it because you did it. You naturally, when I don't know if you grew up on a farm or rural country, but when you're out, like I'll think of being in Alberta at the farm and you're in a barn and you're playing on the bay hails, and all of a sudden the bay hails start to collapse. One falls on you and you're in tears. There's no parent around and you're with your buddies trying to get the bay hails off. You're self-soothing in that moment because you're going through a bit of a crisis. Kids don't go through crises like we did, whether you fall off your bike and there's no, because when you fall off your bike now, your parents are hovering, right? So, there's no chance for a kid to soothe. So you didn't hear about it because, we were self-soothing. We grew up having to self-soothe, and kids nowadays are growing up not having to self-soothe because they're parents are stepping in, or they can grab a phone, or they're not having the opportunity to deal with stress, which has led us to this mental health crisis, right?
I do have to say, I distinctly remember the day when I went over the handlebars of my bike onto the sidewalk, and, I was about a block away from home and my mom was still at work and there was no one was coming for me. And I was pretty banged up, bleeding everywhere. And I just limped home and I took care of it. Yeah. And I didn't, by the time my mom got home from work, it was like a nothing burger, but I'm grateful for my childhood. I'm grateful for being a latchkey kid. Can I say that?
You can. But yeah.
Yes. Cause I learned a lot. I learned how to, depend on myself, how to fend for myself, how to take care of myself and my brother and sister who are younger than me. So I am grateful for my childhood. Thank you for that answer. That is such a good answer. And we need more books like you're writing, especially And Breathe, because I see the cover and it's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Kids, yes, we need this. So thank you. Thank you so much for the work you're doing. Well, we can get to the main question of the podcast now, which I feel like I've taken you down several avenues and roads that were unexpected, but really this has been just such an incredibly meaty and wonderful conversation. I'm so grateful that you're having this conversation with me. But the main question is, I would love, maybe it's a statement. It's actually a statement or a demand. It could be a demand. I would love for you to share a story where you feel like you've experienced something magical or miraculous in your life, something maybe mysterious that you can't explain. Anything you'd like to share, I am here for it.
Well, I guess it's not one thing. It's kind of one of those things that happens to everyone. But it seems like in the last, 5 years, it happens to me more and more where I will think about someone or something, and literally the same day, I will run into that person, or they'll phone or they'll email. And, and I think, when I think of the medicine wheel, the sacred circle, and I think about how, Mother Earth connects everything through the huge ecosystem of the earth, I just think that energy piece. And again, I'm not religious or anything like that, but there's something to be said about, because I'm very good at reading people's auras, and I can feel people when I walk into a room. I can walk into a school and not meet a soul, and I can feel what the school is like, that kind of the thing. But I think one of the coolest things in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years that I've really held on to and I've noticed is that when something crosses my plate and it's something that I thought about, I will pursue it. And I wouldn't before. I'd be like, it's a coincidence. You know what? That's deja vu. It's like, no. And so as that happens more and more, I'm, you know, especially in the last 5 years, but more so in the last 2.5 years, I'm more attuned to when those coincidences happen and I don't ignore them anymore. And I think because of that, and paying attention to it has opened up so many more doors, you know, and more conversations. Like, I never dreamed of being a guest on podcasts when I wrote my book. And now, you know, I just think in the last year, I've had conversations with people from Spain, from England, from India, from New Mexico, from Alabama, from Calgary, from Toronto, you know, and having a conversation with you, Kirsten, is that's what's miraculous, is that because I didn't ignore the obvious sign in front of my face that most people would brush off to a coincidence, it brings me to I never expected that we were going to dive into talking about truth and reconciliation and colonization. I had no idea that was what was going to happen today. And it all came because of this coincidence. And it just so happened that you're fascinated by it. And that's what I'm talking about right there. Capitalizing on those little miracles where we can't ignore something like that, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a subject that, you know, I went to seminary, I have a master's of divinity, to a very liberal seminary. And, you know, I grew up overseas, so I've seen a lot. And in third world countries. And so I'm very aware of the privilege that I have. But I'm also aware that white people, if we can generalize, have done a lot of things that have been incredibly terroristic and damaging to the rest of the world. So I'm always looking for the place where healing can be found. I wanted to just say, if I'm not speaking out of turn, that I bet that school considers you a miracle. Thoughts?
You know what? I think I take a lot of pride in how, have you ever heard of the expression shama? Have you ever heard of what a shama is? So indigenous people where I'm from, they call white people shamas. It's like the N word for white people, I guess. And when I first got there, the first reaction was, you know, and it wasn't said directly to my face, but there was a lot of, is he going to turn this into a shama school, into a white school? And I didn't, I embraced, I went in knowing chief and council needed literacy and numeracy rates to go up because kids need reading, writing, and arithmetic. But I've embraced everything that they are. And now I'm allowed to, it's funny because there's certain things you can't say as a white person that indigenous people can say. And I now, when I say something, they joke about it. They look at me and they say, you know, you're allowed to say that now. And I'm like, well, I'm still a shama. So I don't know if I can. They go, no, you have our permission as long as it's around us. And so I feel like now that there's certain things that they laugh about with me and they joke about with me that I'm one of theirs. And I do refer to them as my family and I refer to the community as my family. And I actually dedicated the book that's coming out in November 1st to the Lower Nickel Indian Band and its community because, yeah, they're my family now. And so, yeah. I think they probably think that because they've let me in the gates and I'm there.
I do think it is incredible what kind of healing, and we can say reconciliation again, when we enter into an encounter with a little humility, maybe, and a little bit of an open mind and a willingness to actually deeply listen to the other person or group or what have you. Just acknowledging that we don't know. I don't know everything. Most people don't know everything. And it's okay to not know everything. Mm-hmm. because I think it makes the encounter, the experience of the mysterious other, so much more fun and adventurous and enchanting. And I think this world could do with a lot more humility. That's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the biggest thing, if I were to offer your audience, and it's something that I tell my kids, particularly my son, now that he's off to college, it's like, check your ego at the door and understand typically when people do or say the wrong thing, it's their ego is interfering with their growth. And so always try to check your ego at the door, because if you do, you will learn so much, so much.
That's a wrap on another episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed the conversation I had with Leroy, and I hope you enjoyed the kind of meanderings that we had, because as Leroy said, and as I said, I never know which direction the wind is going to blow when I'm having these conversations with complete strangers, but we always discover together these little nuggets and avenues that are worth exploring. So I hope you enjoyed the avenues that we went down this week, and I hope you enjoyed meeting Leroy Slanzy. There will be a link to his website and to his books in the episode's show notes. Be sure to check both of them out, because this human being is doing some truly formidable work in the world. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Leroy. Understand that you are only a small part in a much bigger community, in a much bigger world, and in a much bigger universe. I mean, yes, we haven't met those aliens yet out there, but who's to say if they're not already here or not? I mean, they could be standing right next to you in the checkout line. But understand that you are part of a larger community and a much greater cosmos, and that your part, the part that you have to play, is essential and needed and beautiful. And when you show up to do the great work that you are going to do in this world, just know that that community you've surrounded yourself with, that community will have your back each and every time.